News is often thought of answering the five W's: who, what, where, when, and why. I often think of news, though, as determined by answering the five economic W questions. Who cares about a particular piece of information? What are they willing to pay for it? Or what are others willing to pay for their attention? Where else can media outlets or advertisers reach these people? When is it profitable to provide the information? That brings in the cost structure of information. And why is this profitable? And that brings in the definition of property rights to information. It's not as if journalists get out of bed each morning and say, it's a great day to maximize profits. But the set of journalists and the set of stories and the set of news organizations that survive are defined in part by the answers to those five economic W questions. If you think about the economic concepts that help you understand markets for news, one helpful framework has been provided by Anthony Downs in his economic theory of democracy. Downs said that each person essentially has four different types of information demands. They demand information as a consumer. That is the data that helps you find a better price, find a higher quality good. You demand information as a producer. That's the type of information that helps you do your job better. You demand information that's entertainment. That doesn't have to be about Hollywood. It could just be information that you find personally, intrinsically interesting. And then people also demand information in their role as voters, things that help you make a decision about a candidate or an issue. The first three types of information demands work fairly well on the demand side, because if you don't demand and seek out the information, you may not get the benefit. Consider, however, how the information demand works for voting. Even if new information would change your voting decision, and even if you cared greatly about the outcome of a public policy issue, the probability that your one vote would have an impact on the outcome is so tiny. The probability that you might be that marginal voter who, by showing up at the polls, determines the outcome, that probability is so small that the expected value of becoming informed about politics is, for many people, negative. The cost of information, the time of your cost, the subscription cost outweighs the expected benefit. We do see a lot of information about politics, so what explains that? I think of it as the three D's: duty, diversion, and drama. Duty: some people, myself included, believe they have a duty to participate in politics, and that extends to a duty to become informed. That's consuming an identity. That's ideological consumption. Diversion: for some people, looking at C-SPAN is as interesting as looking at ESPN. They just find information about politics intrinsically interesting. Maybe some of those people are watching videos of Marginal Revolution University. And a third information demand that feeds into political coverage might be drama. Maybe a reporter won't tell you about the specifics of debates over the deficit, but maybe they'll tell you who's ahead, who's behind in a horse race function coverage of politics, who's involved in a scandal, who has a better pollster. What this means is that when you think about knowledge about politics, most people remain what Anthony Downs called rationally ignorant about the details of politics. From an investment perspective, it may not pay to spend 2 days trying to figure out your position on a particular policy issue, because you aren't really the marginal decider. That sets up a gap between what people need to know as citizens and what they may want to know as audience members. A second core concept in news markets relates to experience goods versus search goods. Experience goods are ones that are hard for you to know until you experience them. Think about a book or a movie. It may be hard for you to know exactly what's in that information product until you've sampled it or experienced it. A search good is one where you can determine the quality, you can determine how you like it before you buy it. A coat, a pair of shoes might be a search good. A movie title that's sort of quizzical or enigmatic for you might be an experience good. News is an experience good. When you approach a media product, you may not know what has just happened, and you try to figure out whether you want to spend the time consuming it or not. If you think about what stays constant over many media outlets, it's the person. It's the person who's providing the story to you. It could be the broadcaster or the reporter, the columnist or the author. And what that means in a world of increasing channels and increasing news outlets is that the people can become more of the product. There's a greater pressure to provide opinion. There's a greater pressure for a person to become a part of the story. A third thing that's distinctive about news, about public affairs, is that it's costly to create, especially if the government doesn't want you to follow the story, if the government doesn't want you to understand what type of institutional breakdown may be associated with a particular public policy failure. And so when you think about why it may be difficult for the market to generate sufficient amounts of information about public affairs, in part it's because of rational ignorance. People may not demand it. In part, it may be because stories, original stories, creative stories about public policy are costly to create. And that in part may be because the government, through secrecy or through, let's call it slow processing of Freedom of Information Act request, may not make it easy for you to follow a story. What would this look like in the real world? I live in the Raleigh-Durham media market in the United States. It's the 25th largest media market in the United States. My hometown newspaper is the Raleigh News and Observer. If you go back about 6 or 7 years, there were 250 people in the newsroom at the News and Observer. Today, there are fewer than 100. If you look across the United States, in a 3 to 4 year period, about 1 out of 4 people in newsrooms was let go. What that means is that it makes it harder to tell certain types of stories, especially those that are expensive and may not have high expressed viewer interest. One particular story that my newspaper told, the News and Observer, happened in December 2008. In December 2008, the News and Observer published a story that said that over an eight-year period in North Carolina, 580 people who had been out on probation had murdered somebody. That story took the newspaper 6 months to create. It cost them over $200,000 in personnel time and other resources to produce, and it had a very big ripple effect in North Carolina. It changed public policy, it changed funding, it changed how the state tried to approach its probation decision. So in some ways, you could think in economic terms, the News and Observer newspaper generates positive spillovers, positive externalities. Because of that $200,000 investment in 2008, today North Carolina has a different probation system, and the probability is lower that somebody in the state would likely be murdered by somebody out on probation. However, the News and Observer doesn't fully capture the benefits of those stories. What that means, and what I think it is an example of, is when you think about markets for news, the markets for your information as a consumer or as a worker or things that are just fun to know, those can work fairly well. However, in the market for voter information, we see market failures associated with public goods and positive externalities. If you're interested in learning more about this, I hope that you will go to Princeton University Press's website and download for free the first chapter of my book, All the News That's Fit to Sell. Or if you have questions about how news markets operate, I hope that you'll go to Bing and put in James T. Hamilton and contact me and let me know your questions.